I am really having a lot of fun. I hope you, I hope some of you at least are having fun. And I'm learning a lot of great stuff. So it apparently I'm quite wrong about Judaism not having the don't know equanimity. For one thing, it was pointed out to me that that is actually the whole point of the book of Job in the Old Testament. So that was a new piece of information. And a quote from Rambam. Tachlit ha-ye'ida shelo le'ida.
Ma?
Tachlit ha-ye'ida shelo le'ida.
Ah, okay.
That's interesting.
It's not from the
Rambam. It's not from the Rambam.
Someone
in
else?
In the same period. I don't remember who is what.
Okay, well, but I only know what my note says. I'll look it up on the internet, though.
No, but he said something like similar, not exact, like we can know God only in the what like, is no. Know. Okay?
Yeah, that is, it, yeah. Maybe
and I think
that you
Thomas Aquinas based on him. I heard something about that.
Ah.
It's a lot older. It's Moshe Rabbeinu. Sorry, when he's never know what I really am, it's in the Bible.
Okay. So Moshe. Okay. There you go. So that is extremely interesting, what you just said. Because Maimonides was an influence on Thomas Aquinas, who I quoted. Thomas Aquinas is the main authority in Catholic, Roman Catholic scholastic philosophy. And I know the quote in Latin, so I have to get the original from the Hebrew. Okay, maybe you could look that up for me.
In the Rambam?
Huh?
About what is known?
Yes, that's
in the first part in Moreh Nevuchim, chapter 50 or 51.
This is impressive. In the Latin, it's Deus tam quam per ignorantium cogniscimus. We know God directly through a kind of not knowing. That's Thomas Aquinas. That's the Catholic point of view. But it sounds like there's a little bit of a Jewish point of view behind that, which is historically extremely interesting. So thanks for sharing that. The point, of course, is not the idea, but the experience. So that's what we're here to do. So thanks for the education. Yesterday, or so far, we've covered one way to think about what mindful awareness is. And we've talked about why mindful awareness, why we should develop mindful awareness so that we can be personally happy in every way possible, and so that we can spread happiness to others in every way possible. In other words, these are core skills that directly or indirectly relate to every dimension of human well-being. Okay, so we know we have an idea what it is, we have an idea of why it's important. These are all the interrogative words. I talked a little bit yesterday about, well, the fancy word in English is whence. Whence means from where. Okay, so whence did it come? Where did mindfulness come from? A conjecture as to its prehistoric origins in tribal life. And then talked a little bit about the historical Buddha. Now, when you think of the Buddha, what do you think of? Most people, some people, when you say Buddha, they think of some like big fat guy with a big smile on his face. You know what I mean? And you rub his belly for good luck.
Chinese one.
Well, it is true. If you go to restaurant or a store or something, you might see this sort of like fat-looking Buddha guy with a big smile on his face. That, however, is actually not the Buddha. That's another fellow. That's a guy that in Japan is called Hotei, and in Chinese is called Budai. That's a very interesting thing, though. He was a Chan master. Chan is the Chinese pronunciation of Zen. He was a Zen master who lived in the Tang Dynasty. For some reason, people think that's the Buddha. In fact, even the Chinese call him Xiaomianfo, which means the laughing Buddha. But historically, it's a different person, and you can look it up. His story is an interesting story. The actual historical Buddha lived about 2,500 years ago, and I doubt that he was very fat, since he only ate one meal a day for most of his life. Most of the world in Asia, most of the Asian world, if you say Buddha, it's almost like a god, okay? And they have statues, and that's the way most people in Asia think about the Buddha. That's the popular religion. Or if they get beyond that sort of deification piece, they might think that, well, he had all the answers. His formulations can never be improved upon, and has the last word to say about the nature of the human condition. So a sort of infallible authority as to how things are. At least an infallible authority, or even perhaps a god. Let's be honest. That's the way a lot of Asia would think about the Buddha. Personally, that is not at all the way I think about the Buddha. And you're welcome to think about the Buddha any way you want. But to me, I think of him as the first and so far greatest scientist of human happiness. There are many things in his formulation that parallel the method of science. Not everything. Not by no means not everything, but certain things about what he was the way he went about his endeavor are similar to what a scientist does. He was very analytic. He broke things down into components and said, if you look at the way they interact, you'll get insights. Well, that's exactly what scientists do. You break things down into atoms, and then the interactions of the atoms explain material properties, chemical properties, and so forth. He rejected authority. He himself said, you don't have to believe something just because I say so. In other words, he himself actually said, I'm not an infallible authority. But of course, future generations make him into an infallible authority. The Buddha said that there are three ways to know something. Reliable authority, logical inference, and direct experience. And of those three, he rejected authority of all sorts and said rely only on direct experience and what is logically reasonable. Well, that's exactly what scientists do also. So a lot of his approach was, if not scientific, proto-scientific. it's like, could be made fully scientific, perhaps. So, a scientist is not necessarily perfect, even in their specialty. They might say things that turn out to not be correct. If you go to the internet and look at the article on Einstein, you'll find about 20 things that he believed about physics that aren't true. He was wrong. But he was right in original ways about other things that were earth-shakingly important. Also, a scientist, each generation of scientists builds on the previous generations. Richard Feynman, who was a famous physicist when I was a little boy, he built upon work of others, including Einstein. Einstein built upon the work of Maxwell. Maxwell built upon the work of Lagrange and Hamilton. Lagrange and Hamilton built upon the work of Newton. Newton built upon the work of Kepler. Kepler built upon the work of Copernicus and Galileo. And in each generation, the science improved. My teacher, you've maybe seen the book, Sasaki Roshi, he's an old-time Zen master. He's like old school. He has no modern education at all. But he's extraordinary because he says that if you're as enlightened as your teacher, you're only half as enlightened as your teacher. What does that mean? It doesn't exactly compute mathematically. Well, what it means is if you're as enlightened as your teacher, you're halfway to where you need to be. The other half is, can you come up with something new and improved that works better than your teacher? He actually says that. Also, the Dalai Lama of Tibet has told people that I know, friends of mine, scientists, ask them to find better ways through science to bring people to enlightenment. So some people in the Buddhist world, not just me, okay, but some very traditional people that speak with authority in the Buddhist world are saying that because the Buddha was a proto-scientist, we should try to be innovative and see if we can evolve further. Actually, there's a long history of that. That's why there's so many different styles of Buddhist practice. People experimented and they found new things. So when I personally think about the Buddha, I think of a normal human being that did an extraordinary practice and discovered some things that people had not discovered before and organized them in a way that no one had done before that was very effective. But it's still possible, this is my opinion, that some of the things he said were not correct. It's still possible that there's room for improvement, that new things could be understood, science of enlightenment would evolve through time like other sciences. So that's a sort of vision that I have. When you look historically, you see the early practice of the Buddha has been roughly more or less preserved in Southeast Asia. So Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, that area, Laos, Cambodia, the lineage of Buddhism there is called Theravada, It means the teaching of the elders, literally. Theravada is the sole surviving school of Hinayana, small vehicle. And Hinayana, although it sounds like a prejudiced word, we say small, it's just the label that scholars use for the more conservative form of Buddhism that we think is rather close to what the actual historical Buddha taught. Not identical, but it's close relative to other things. So what happened in India is the Buddha lived about 2,500 years ago. And he formulated his system, which he called Dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A. Now, if I had to translate Dharma into English, I would say natural spiritual law. By the way, it's D-H, so that means it's a D and you blow out a little bit of air. It's not Dharma, okay? It's Dharma. And he's not Buddha. He's Buddha. Two D's and an H. That's how it's pronounced in proper Pali and Sanskrit. So he formulated his Dharma about roughly 2,500 years ago. It died out in India around the year 1200 AD. So, you know, about 800 years ago, Buddhism disappeared from India. Do you know the main cause for the disappearance of Buddhism? The Islamic invasions of India. Islam came in from the West, and it gradually conquered across North India. And by around the year 1200, it reached the heartland of Buddhism, which is Bihar and Bengal, that region, the northeastern part of India, and they wiped out the Buddhist settlers. And that was more or less the end of Buddhism in India until now, when it's being reintroduced from other places in the modern time. However, between roughly 500 BC and roughly 1200 AD, Buddhism was in India and it evolved. Some people kept the older forms and they came to be known as Hinayana or small vehicle. Other people changed things. They changed the emphasis. So remember, one of the things the Buddha taught was anicca, things change. Well, even Buddhism, even the Dharma, or at least the formulation of the Dharma, had some people changed it. They were innovators. Around 2,000 years ago, so very approximately 500 years after the Buddha died, and because a Buddha doesn't exactly die. If you have gone beyond birth and death, your physical body dies like anybody else. But since you've already become life and death itself, you can't quite say that you can die anymore. Because that's what my teacher says, okay? Until you become, you yourself become life and death, expansion and contraction, until you become the activity of the source, then you'll always be at the mercy of life and death. You'll always be at the mercy of affirmation and negation. And when you're affirmed, you'll be happy, and when you're negated, you'll be unhappy. Until you actually, you yourself, become life and death, then you are free from life and death. It sounds strange, but this is the Zen formulation. So, a Buddha's body dies, but it's not quite proper to say that a Buddha actually dies. So then do they go on forever? No, we don't say that either, okay? The Buddha said, you can't say that an enlightened person exists after death, but you can't say that they don't exist. Neither of those descriptions quite fits the reality. So I know that's really hard to understand. What is that? So then Sasaki Roshi makes it even weirder. He says, well, you don't die because you've become death and life, both. That's what somebody asked me, what enlightenment is. Oh, there's a lot of ways to answer that question. One way is enlightenment is to be completely alive and completely dead at exactly the same time. Okay, in any event, after the Buddha's death, about 500 years after the Buddha's parinirvana, or quote, death, a new school arose called Mahayana. Maha means great or large. Yana means vehicle. And the Buddha put a lot of emphasis on each individual becoming liberated. Now, of course, if we look at his life, what he actually did, he was enlightened at the young age of 35. He died at the age of 80. That means for 45 years, he lived. And what he did during those 45 years was service to humanity. He served humanity. He helped people. So if you look at his life is a life of service. But if you look at his philosophy puts a very large emphasis on escaping from suffering. So about 2,000 years ago, the Mahayana movement arose, and it said, an individual escaping from suffering, yes, that's important, but helping others is equally important. And the goal shouldn't be that I just go off, attain nirvana, and then I'm done, I'm free. The goal should be to stay in the world forever, because they believe in reincarnation. So the idea is come back time after time after time to continue to help everyone, to help everyone materially and spiritually, so that it's a kind of, the ideal should be an eternity of service to creation. And the person that practices with the goal of, on one hand, themselves becoming enlightened, but on the other hand, forever serving sentient beings, that person is called bodhisattva. And so the goal in Mahayana is that compassion, service, is equally important to liberation and transcendence. So the Buddha actually lived the life of compassion and service, but his philosophy was a little bit lopsided. It was like, okay, get out of suffering. Just go off, attain nirvana, don't come back. So Mahayana sort of corrected that, balanced it. That happened about 2,000 years ago. The rise of Mahayana is the rise of the notion of the bodhisattva, the person for whom service and liberation are equally important. The rise of Mahayana is also associated with the philosophy that there's an intimate link between emptiness and compassion. It sounds strange. Why should nothingness lead to human caringness? But it does. So if you've studied Buddhist history, you know that the Mahayana scriptures, we call them scriptures, the suttas, they talk a lot about shunyata, emptiness. What else is associated with Mahayana? Well, as Mahayana arises, that's when the Buddha stops being a normal human being and starts to be looked upon as some sort of god. It's with the rise of Mahayana is when they started to make statues. That's when they started to have mythology. There's not just the man, the Buddha, but there's like a Buddha in the east and a Buddha in the west and a Buddha of the north and a Buddha of the south. They developed what's called a pantheon. You understand what this word means?
Yeah.
It's the same as the Greeks and the Romans and in Hinduism. There's like a collection of gods that people venerate. So mythology and, if I may say, religion starts to come in. And Buddhism starts to become a religion like other religions, with rituals, with deities, etc., etc., rather than, as I say, a dharma, a path that a person developed and other people found useful. So is this good or bad? Well, you could argue it either way. Okay, and I am quite happy to argue it either way. So with the rise of Mahayana, you have this wonderful ideal of the Bodhisattva. You also have the rise of Buddhism is becoming like a religion, okay? And that's Mahayana. That Mahayana continues to evolve in India for a long time. By about the year 700 AD, so another 500 years, Mahayana has evolved into something called Vajrayana, diamond vehicle, V-A-J-R-A-Y-A-N-A. And with Vajrayana, Buddhism becomes a full-blown initiatory religion with authority of priests and just all the trappings of Hinduism. Buddhism is almost indistinguishable in a sense from Hinduism on the surface. But in the depths, it's still Buddhism. The center of practice with Vajrayana shifts to rituals. But these are rituals that have inside of them very elaborate meditation techniques, which I mentioned when I talked about deity yoga, and there's a lot more. There's a lot to it. My academic specialty was going to be Vajrayana. That's what I was going to do my dissertation on. So there's a lot we can say about it. Okay, so then that's about 700 AD, and then and Vajrayana evolves in India for 500 years, and then it all sort of ends. Buddhism is sort of gone from. So the big picture, as far as the historical evolution of Buddhism in India, is first 500 years or so, Hinayana, somewhat close to the Buddha's method, and somewhat still sees the Buddha as a person, and the Dharma is not really a religion, it's a methodology. Then about 500 years after his death, Mahayana arises, things are starting to sort of become religious, for better or worse. And the Buddha now has statues and is sort of beginning to be deified. But then you have this wonderful philosophy at the same time that helping others, service, is as important as escaping from the limited existence, from the cycle of rebirth. So that sort of then evolves in India into Vajrayana, where in some ways a case could be made if you wanted to argue that Vajrayana is the exact opposite of what the historical Buddha taught. Okay? This might offend some people, but if you ask me to list ways in which Vajrayana is absolutely the opposite of what the historical Buddha taught, I could go down a list. On the other hand, it could also be looked upon as an improvement, an evolution. Certain techniques that didn't exist with the Buddha are there. There's all sorts of interesting things that are not in early Buddhist literature that are quite powerful, that are found in the Vajrayana practice. So is it expansion? Is it an evolution? Or is it contraction? Is it a devolution? Or going backwards? Well, we could look at it either way. Roughly speaking. So what I've given you is now is time. I wanted you to get a sense of the big picture as far as the historical development of Buddhism in India. Essentially three periods, each dominated by a different school. Hinayana dominates for about 500 years. Mahayana then dominates for another 700 or so. Then Vajrayana for another 500. Then the Islamic invasions more or less destroy Buddhism.
When were the Brahmins?
The Brahmanas?
The
Hindus. The, what was the what?
The
Brahmanism?
Okay.
Brahmanism preceded Buddhism. The Buddha lived about 500 BC. Prior to the Buddha, there existed in India the Vedic religion. The Vedic religion was brought, V-E-D-A. These are the names of the scriptures. The Vedic religion was brought to India by the Indo-European invaders who came to India maybe around 1500 BC. And those Indo-European invaders spoke Sanskrit. And Sanskrit is the became the basis of the languages of North India. They're called Indo-Europeans because most of the languages between North India and Europe belong to the Indo-European language family. Sanskrit is the classical language of North India. Another Indo-European language is Persian. Another Indo-European language is English, that I am now speaking. Linguistically, the Buddha was a Westerner. He spoke an Indo-European language. So the Indo-Europeans, the Sanskrit speakers, came into India at an early period, and their religion was centered around mythology and rituals. Okay? So then what happened? And that's Brahmanism. Their priests are called Brahmins. Okay? So what happened is you had this Vedic religion that was centered around mythology and rituals. Then there developed other movements where people went off and just meditated. And they were called Shramanas, as opposed to Brahmana. Brahmanas were the priests who had the Vedic religion. And then the Shramanas were people that were off meditating, practicing, doing yoga, exploring other philosophies. And among the important Shramanas were the Jains. And the Buddha studied with the Jains. And then he went off and developed his own thing. So there was the sort of early religion in India, Brahmanism or Hinduism, early Hinduism, centered around the Vedas. Those scriptures were thought to be divinely revealed and perfect. And there was a priest caste that implemented the rituals, and the Vedic religion centered around ritual and scripture and a pantheon of deities. Now, the deities, the gods and goddesses of the Vedic world are the same gods and goddesses of Greece and Rome, because the Greeks and the Romans and the Persians and the Sanskrit speakers who invaded India were once one tribe, about 5,000 BC. And they spoke one language called Proto-Indo-European. So the mythologies of ancient India, ancient Persia, and the Greeks and the Romans and the Teutonic people, there are many similarities, and it's not a coincidence. It's extraordinary. So what's sort of interesting is, in a sense, when you look at, so there was like this Vedic religion centered on ritual and on priestly authority and on the power of ceremonies to actually like influence the world. That was the Vedic religion. Then the Shramanas broke away from that, and they were more like liberation, meditation. And the Buddha was the greatest of the Shramanas. And he was even called Mahashramana, the great Shramana. So you had the Brahmanas, who were the priests of the Vedic religion, and the Shramanas were a sort of revolt against that. And the greatest and most influential of the Shramanas was the Buddha. And then, but then look what happens. 500 years, it's starting to look a little more like the Vedas, okay? And another 700 years, it is the Vedas. You're back to rituals, you're back to priestly authority, you're back to scriptural authority. It's like the Hindu thing just sort of swamped the Dharma thing from a certain point of view. From another point of view, Mahayana is a step forward because it's a more balanced, in my way of thinking, it's a more balanced formulation than early Buddhism because it emphasizes service as well as liberation. And Vajrayana is also an evolution because they have so many techniques that early Buddhism didn't have. So you can look at it either way, but that's the answer to your question. So as this is happening in India, Buddhism is going out of India and being exported to Asia. And so you sort of got the big picture of Buddhist development in India. Now, what's happening in the rest of the world? Well, very roughly speaking, I'm giving you a gross oversimplification so you can get the big picture, because Buddhist history is very complicated. And it's easy, you know, the expression we have that you can't see the forest because of the trees. There's so much detail that you might not see that there is a big picture here. The big picture is the early Buddhist practice, Hinayana, it's preserved in Southeast Asia. Died out in India, preserved in Southeast Asia. I mean, yes, it's been reintroduced now in the modern time into India. But historically, it's associated with Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia preserves Hinayana. The representative practice, meditation practice of Hinayana is what we're doing here. This is the representative meditation technique, mindfulness. Particularly mindfulness in the sense of untangle and unblock. The kind of thing we're doing here is very much in the spirit of early Buddhism. What happens to Mahayana? Mahayana goes into China. As it's evolving in India, there are trade routes. It's very interesting. There are trade routes between here, the Middle East, and the Mediterranean, okay? There are trade routes that link the Eastern Mediterranean with India, and India to China. Do you know what those trade routes are called? They have an interesting name.
The Silk Road.
Why called Silk Road? Well, silk is a Chinese invention. Only the Chinese knew how to make silk. So for centuries, silk traveled as a commodity. China to India, India to here. okay, the Eastern Mediterranean, and from here to the rest of the Western world. Roman emperors wore Chinese silk. Where did they get it? Through that Silk Road. But the travel could go the opposite direction. So silk came from China to India. The Dharma went from India to China along those same trade routes. Buddhist monks and nuns, practitioners, they brought Buddhism into China. So when Buddhism went into China about 2,000 years ago, the Chinese had already had 2,000 years of their own civilization. Chinese civilization is about as ancient as Jewish civilizations. Good 5,000 years there. So Buddhism is just a late arrival from a foreign country into China. The Chinese had their own civilization. They had their own literature. They had their own philosophies. What are the native philosophies of China?
Confucianism
and Taoism. So when Buddhism went into Southeast Asia, Hinayana goes into Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, those countries did not have any written language. They didn't have any highly developed civilization. They had culture, of course, but it was a tribal culture. So Buddhism became the center for Southeast Asian culture. The culture, you cannot think of Thailand or Burma without considering Buddhism. Buddhism is at the center of it. When Buddhism went into China, though, very different situation. They had their own civilization. And they began to change Buddhism. In Southeast Asia, they preserved, more or less, Buddhism as they got it from India. But the Chinese started to make Buddhism into something Chinese. And that means Taoist influence and Confucian influence. And you can see how that played out. And by the Tang Dynasty, say the 8th century, Buddhism in China has become very Chinese and very non-Indian. And it's turned, the main practice has turned into something that in Mandarin Chinese is called Chan, but in Japanese is, and there's a lot of innovations in Zen, and they're primarily based on the influence of Confucianism and Taoism. So ways of meditating that never existed in Buddhism, in India, were developed in China. The notion of a koan, what is the sound of one hand clapping, okay? These sort of problems that put you into equanimity with don't know, that method of practice never existed in India. The notion that enlightenment is a kind of oneness with all things, that's a Taoist notion. The idea that you can make physical labor a meditation practice, not in India, there's karma yoga, but not in the Buddhist, okay? Buddhist monks and nuns don't work because the word for work, W-O-R-K, in Sanskrit is karma, and karma has a negative connotation. Whereas in China, there's a Confucian work ethic. So in the Chan or Zen temples, most of the meditation centers around labor. And it centers of the technique in my manual that's called Focus Out, where you see out, hear out, feel out, you pay attention to the physical world. That's the first thing that the Zen monks are taught, because they have to learn how to meditate while they work. That's a very different methodology from the notion of how to meditate in India. So, and then some of the Zen schools developed the notion of just sit, just let go of all effort. Well, the Buddha talked about making effort. It was all about seeking. He talked about Arya Pariyasana. It's this noble quest. You have to really, really work hard. The last words he said before he died, Anicca Sankara, everything is impermanent. Work out your own personal liberation with diligence. That was the last thing he said. The Buddha was all into bearing down and working hard. But there's a whole other side to practice. Easing up and letting go. Wasn't in early Buddhism, but some of the Zen schools, they have this shikantaza, just sit, do nothing, silent reflection, etc., etc. So new styles of liberation arose from the cross-fertilization of Chinese civilization and Indian Mahayana. And they give rise to this child called Chan or Zen. That's an important practice tradition. So what is Zen? Zen is a East Asian reformulation of Mahayana Buddhism. What about Vajrayana? Well, that goes into Tibet primarily. So the stuff that when we think about Tibet, most of that was not developed in Tibet. Some of it is Tibetan innovation. There's a few things that were created in Tibet, like Chö, and that kind of stuff. But most of what is practiced in Tibet as Vajrayana goes back to India, late Indic Buddhism. So, roughly speaking, geographically, there are three major practice traditions, very approximately. Mindfulness from Southeast Asia, Zen from East Asia, and Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle, now preserved in Tibet, Nepal, and so forth, but originally going back to Indic sources. So if you keep that in mind, you'll sort of have the broad outline for how Buddhism evolved historically. Earlier today, I talked about the visualization practice that is distinctive to Vajrayana. There are other practices that are there that are not in Zen, and they're certainly not in early Buddhism. I can't go into the details of that, but at least, you now have sort of the big picture of how Buddhism changed and evolved. So, or more specifically, how Buddhist practice had its origins and evolved in many ways through creativity and cultural interactions. It's very rich. Yes?
Zen and Chan.
Essentially, Zen is the Japanese pronunciation of the same character that in Mandarin is Chan. So East Asia, what used to be called the Far East, that's an obsolete term. We now call it East Asia. So there are four major cultures in East Asia. China, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. Vietnam, although it's in Southeast Asia, is culturally part of East Asia. It's an extension of South China. So each of the four East Asian regions has Zen. So in China, it's called Chan. In Korea, it's called Sun. In Japan, it's called Zen. And in Vietnam, it's called Tien. So that's why, some of you are into Thich Nhat Hanh. Okay, so he's Vietnamese. That means his lineage is actually Zen. It's Chinese Mahayana. That historical lineage. But Vietnam is right next to Cambodia and not far from Thailand and Burma. So Vietnam gets some influence from mindfulness from its Theravada neighbors. So Vietnam is interesting in that regard. One of the things that's so attractive about Thich Nhat Hanh as a teacher is that his basic lineage is Zen, Tien. The Vietnamese pronunciation of Zen is Tien, T-H-I-E-N. So his lineage is Zen, and he writes poems in Chinese, okay? But there's a mindfulness influence from Cambodia. There's also a Christian influence. This whole idea of like social, you know, movement or whatever. Well, that's a sort of good influence from Catholicism, I would say, on to Vietnamese Buddhism. Social.
Singing.
Yeah, Buddhism originally didn't have any idea of social. It was like withdrawal. Okay. So, yes, Chan is Chinese Zen. Or, put another way, Zen is Japanese Chan.
Where does Dzogchen come
from? Dzogchen is a practice in Tibet that has complicated historical origins, but probably there is some Zen influence in it, because the Dzogchen practice in Tibet is rather similar, roughly, well, let's just put it this way, where Dzogchen practice ends up is rather similar to the just sitting sort of form of Zen. And remember, Dzogchen is found in eastern Tibet, but eastern Tibet is also western China. So, you know, there's probably some Zen influence on its development. But anyway, that's sort of where that fits. So, this is the big picture of what has been. This is where this came from and how it has evolved through time. So, what will be the... So, we have the what, the why, we have a little bit of the where, and the from what. Can we say where it's going? Well, no one can predict the future. But we can look to the past and make conjectures as to what might happen in the future. Some people are worried and depressed about what might happen to us, to humanity in this century. I have no idea what will happen to humanity in this century, but I don't find myself worried or depressed. Because whatever may be happening on the surface that's sort of not great, there's something very deep and very slow that's happening below the surface that I'm aware of because of what I do for a living. And that thing that's happening that's very deep and very slow is that the discoveries of the Buddha are starting to influence modern civilization. In a very significant way, not in a superficial way. There was a famous historian named Arnold Toynbee. You might have heard of him. Toynbee said something extraordinary, and this is like a professional historian, someone whose job it is to see the big picture of history. And he was one of the most famous scientific historians. Toynbee, I am paraphrasing, but he said something like, in the end, it may turn out that the single most significant event of the 20th century will turn out to be the discovery on the part of the West of Buddhism. Okay, think about that, okay? That all the things that happened in the 20th century... A lot happened in the 20th century. One of the things that happened in the 20th century is what happened to me. Westerners starting to seriously practice Buddhism, not just study it or think about it, but actually go there and do it the way people in Asia do it, the real deal. Okay? So, in the 20th century, some Westerners started they discovered Buddhism as a science of spirituality and happiness. So Toynbee says it could be that that's going to turn out, you know, when 500 or 1,000 years from now, if history is written, they'll forget about all that other stuff. And it's like, it was in the 20th century that the best of the East met the best of the West. Rise to a new age, you know, for humanity. If we look at what has happened previously, don't get me wrong, I am not claiming this will happen. That would be ludicrous to claim it will happen. However, I can see that it could happen. Look at the past. Buddhism, Hinayana Buddhism, comes into Southeast Asia, encounters a tribal culture, and isn't changed very much. They just preserve it. It comes into Tibet, encounters a tribal culture. It's changed a little, but not a whole lot. They sort of preserve Vajrayana that they got, the Sanskrit mantras, the texts that they got from India. Buddhism comes into China. Oh, changed big time. You would hardly even recognize it. It's so changed. It became so Chinese. Why? Because of the richness and complexity and depth of Chinese civilization. It had to interact with that. And there was a cross-fertilization that was creative and powerful. Now we have Buddhism coming into the quote West. And when I say quote West, West just means the modern world, okay? It doesn't mean like Europe and America. It just means the modern world. So Buddhism is coming to the quote West. Well, it's good. It's encountering an incomparably more complex and deeper civilization, because the modern world has science. China didn't. No one did. And science is very, very powerful. So now Buddhism's coming into the West. What's happening? Well, a lot is happening. Buddhism, not Buddhism, but mindfulness meditation is now routinely used in conjunction with psychotherapy. It's not marginal to psychotherapy. It's like central. Mindfulness is the hot topic in psychotherapy. I grew up in the 50s. I can remember reading books by psychiatrists that claimed that Buddhist meditation was a form of insanity. I was so like disappointed. It's like, I thought this was so cool, and this psychiatrist, who's a doctor, says it's just a form of psychosis. I had a lot of doubts, and it bothered me, okay? Now, Buddhist-type techniques, not Buddhism, but mindfulness practice, is a routine part of psychotherapy, and getting more so. There was a publication that came out a few months ago, Psychotherapy Networker, it's the name of a magazine, for professionals in psychotherapy, okay, like a professional journal for therapists. And you know what the lead story was? On the cover is like you see this sort of doctor that looks like Freud a little bit, and he's like has this lemonade stand, and then there's this Buddhist nun, and she has another lemonade stand, and everybody's in line for the Buddhist nun's lemonade, and the psychiatrist is looking like, you know, like sad and confused because no one wants buy his drink anymore. Okay, now this is a magazine for therapists, and the lead article was the mindfulness revolution. Do we even need therapy anymore? Can you believe that? We've come that far, okay? Mindfulness is looked upon as so powerful that some therapists are saying, well, you know, therapy's, it's done. And where did psychology start? William James at Harvard University 100 years ago said, in the next century, we'll be learning our psychology from Buddhist monks. He actually said that. He predicted it. It's actually happening. But psychology is one thing. Neuroscience and the Dalai Lama dialoguing with Nobel laureate physicists. This is a whole other thing, okay? So if we look back on history and we say, well, Buddhism came into China, it encountered a rich and complex civilization that was very different from India, and it really changed, then we can surmise, we can guess, that Buddhism coming into the Western world will be strongly impacted by the thing that is uniquely powerful that the West developed, which is science. And when you, that's why I started this talk by saying, how do you think about the Buddha? If you think about the Buddha as some sort of religious authority or some sort of, worse still, some sort of deity, well, that's one thing. But if you think about the Buddha as the first and so far greatest scientist of true human happiness, well, that's something, a very different view of things. And that gives the possibility that there can be a continuing evolution of the Dharma informed by science. And I see enormous potential for goodness to increase on this planet as the result of the mating of the best of the East and the best of the West. Like I say, can't say it will happen, but I can say I'm a professional meditator, okay? That's my profession. I have a professional level of expertise as far as meditation goes. I'm a pretty good amateur scientist. I consult, or, you know, on projects at big famous universities with big scientists. So I'm not professionally trained, but for an amateur, I'm pretty good. And I just say that based on what I know of these two worlds, it's not hard for me to imagine them cooperating in the next 100 years, and that something really quite stunning could come out of that gradually, slowly. So while all this, you know, balagan is going on the surface, I see a real beseder slowly, 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 without people really knowing, okay? People don't realize there's a continental drift that's occurring in world civilization by these two meeting, and it may turn out that Toynbee was correct. So anyway, I just share that with you as an optimistic point of view that I have about things. So now we know what it is. We know why it's important. We know where it came from. And we have some conjecture as to where it might be going to. So we've answered a lot of good questions. There's one more question that needs to be addressed, which is, okay, now that we know all this,
how to make money out of it?
How to make money? How to get, you know the story? You know the story about Einstein? The story about Einstein? Einstein's mother says, you know, what are you doing? And he said, well, I developed relativity. And she says, well, what's relativity? It's, well, if you sit on a hot stove Time passes more slowly than if you sit holding a pretty girl. That's not really what it is, okay? That's the joke. And then she says, and with this you make a living? So, yes. No, that's not the next thing. It's not how to get gelt out of the Dharma. The next thing is, what do you have to, what do you have to organize in your life? How do you organize your life? What do you have to get in place in order to be able to successfully practice mindfulness? So what are the elements that you need in order to, when you leave this retreat, be able to continue with practice and grow with practice? So that's sort of like, what do you need to be successful? So we've covered what is it, and why it's important. We've covered where it came from and where it may go to. So tomorrow, our last talk will be, okay, here's what you need to be successful. What do you need to be successful? And then I think we've covered all the big questions about this. So, yeah.